Hello, welcome to Stomping Grounds with me, William Stone. If you haven't been before, it's all about me talking to other comedians about where they grew up and what impact that has on our lives. Today I'm going to be talking to Celia AB, who's a fantastic new comic. You might not have heard of her yet, but I'm certain you will know her in the near future. Again, down to the internet, the audio on this one is not ideal, but I think it's passable. That's why I'm putting it out, and I hope you enjoy it. So, do it up. Let me know what you think. Cheers.
I guess you are what most people would describe as French, right?
Yeah, I'm. That's interesting because I am from France, but my family's originally half French and Algerian.
Right.
So in France, I'm Algerian, but in Britain, I'm French. Which is...
That's really interesting. So you're always othered wherever you go, basically.
Like... Absolutely. I think I kind of like revel in that. I've always felt like a bit of an outsider, and not in a like cool, quirky way, like, oh my God, I drink coffee, but like more in a, like,
Is coffee not very big in France?
Oh, never heard of it. I've kind of based my personality around being an outsider, I think, in a way.
I think that's really good. I've spoken about this before on the podcast, but I think it's conducive to good comedy being an outsider because you notice things more from an outside perspective than when you're inside, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's like, well, you can see it when it's the base of when people go on holiday and they just come back with like loads of facts about how the Spanish do things. It's like, my life is like this. Like since being in Britain, it's made me notice things about the British, but it's also made me notice things about the French. And it's quite interesting.
That's interesting.
Whenever I go back home, I'm then the outsider because I haven't been in France in 6 years. And it's quite like, I've always got that balance of like, okay, what is going on?
That is really interesting. So you grew up in France. Was it in Paris? Is that right? Or is that where you lived a bit later on?
Yeah, so I'm from a little place just outside Paris, which is called Épinay-sur-Seine, and it's in France. I mean, Paris is like done by department, and so mine would be 93, and it's famously one of the worst ones to be from. But I was from the so I grew up there. My whole family lived there. I used to live in a flat with I've got two brothers and my mom and dad. And then what's interesting is that growing up, this town was really a nothing kind of town where nothing had come out of it. The only famous thing about it is that there was one of the animation studios was there. But it clearly was like people who were coming from the center of Paris to record and then just leave and like have a shower straight away. It was just like, we had... it was very, really much nothing happened in that town. It wasn't like dangerous in that sense, but you definitely felt a sense of people just had been here for 40 years and no one was really leaving. I went to my primary school was just opposite the high school. So I really would stay within the same street growing up. I remember I never felt like I belonged in that town because I was really overweight growing up. And obviously, if you're overweight in France, it's worse because everyone's really thin and pretty. I was really into metal, whereas everyone was really into hip hop. I remember just feeling like I never really fitted in. The town, that's the thing. We would have the only event that would be on would be they would have the worst French singers that you haven't heard of in 20 years just doing their comeback tours in the event hall that we would have. And yeah, it really was a nothing kind of town, but it wasn't quaint. That's what I need to stress is that it wasn't like, it was just very boring, very samey. And everybody was kind of... the same. There was no one was really different from one another.
I see. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, did you, were there any kind of, I suppose if somewhere's quite dull, then people that are even a little bit different probably stand out more. So did you have any kind of like local, like legendary characters or people that were a bit, you know, that everyone knew for good or bad reasons?
Yeah, so like, I don't know if it's just, I feel like it's the same across the world, but I feel like everywhere in the world, there's a guy that walks without shoes on. And that's like the... and I remember that this guy was like, we gave him a surname, which was Pied du Sol, which means earth foot. And there was a legend that he was doing that because he wanted to feel closer to the earth, but it's not the earth. It's like
concrete.
I know. And so there was this guy, and there was also this lady who I remember I used to walk past her house to go to the train station when I was going to high school. Mm. And legend had it that she once pulled a knife on someone and said that if they were to walk past her house ever again, it would be the end of them. Don't know if that actually happened, but we went with it. And she probably was a normal lady, but I think when you come from like a dull place, you need those sort of myths. You need those things to just make it interesting and have something to talk about. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
Like, I think that we really had nothing going on except for the weird people that we would, bully in a way, because they were probably very nice people, but we just created those myths around them. I think that growing up, we definitely felt like, we all felt like writers trying to write Twin Peaks. Like, we were just trying to like have something scary or weird. I think there was a haunted house as well that everyone was to avoid.
Amazing.
But it was, in terms of local legends, I feel like they're very interchangeable. Sorry, my English.
That's but all right.
In the sense that I think every town has these little things, which probably come from like really ancient books and we're all just recreating it. But no one famous ever came out of my town. Even the like, for a town that was really huge into hip hop, no good hip hop has come out of it. So yeah,
I guess that's the problem when you are quite near to a big city. So like, even if someone like big did come out of there, they'd probably just say they were from Paris. You know what I mean? Because it makes it easier for other people to understand. It's a bit like me, where I come from quite a nondescript place that no one's ever heard of. So when I say I'm from Northwich, they're like, Norwich? Like, no, Northwich. So when I went to university, I just said I was from Manchester, and I'm not, but it's the nearest place that people know. Because even if I say Chester, they're like, what's that? You know what I mean? It's amazing.
It's also because I think there's like stereotypes based on towns, right? So it's also about people relating. So if you say you're from Manchester, they could be like, oh, there's that really good pizza place. And then you can just try and bond. But I found myself like speaking to people who were from Paris or had been to Paris, like British people there, and they know about, they had a completely different experience from me because they've obviously been to really fancy restaurants and they were staying in a nice hotel. And so I find myself like kind of like pretending to relate. Like I'm like, oh yeah, it's like the Louvre. Love it.
I have my lunch there every day. Yeah.
I know. Oh, the Eiffel Tower. What a lad. But it's like, it's interesting because when I went to school, it's not a very rich part of the outskirts of Paris. It's very working class.
Right.
But I went to, not high school, college. I went to college in the town near us, which was very middle class, very middle to upper class.
Right.
And they had a lake and it was beautiful. And it was like a completely different world for us. It was very beautiful, very... In terms of the way people looked, it was different because where I'm from was very much North African. Mm-hmm. And in that town right next door, it was just the white to white, just wall to wall. And it was very strange. And I went to college there because I wanted to get away from that little town. And there I was confronted with people who had money and disposable income, and I had no idea how to handle that.
Right.
They talk about going on holiday, and I was like, I couldn't relate. So again, I found myself just
an outsider again.
Yeah. And it was like, it's weird because I felt like, I think I was looking to find people who would, who I could relate to, but I found myself even more estranged in a way.
Mm.
Like to be around people who had a completely different experience from me in life. Mm. And it was very strange. It was very, very strange. I think that a lot of teenagers feel that way. I think we all, when you're a teenager, you don't really know who you are. Yeah. But if you are similar to other people, you have a better idea. But I really struggled to understand where I fit when I was younger, definitely.
That's interesting. It leads me on to what I was going to ask you about, actually, because I don't know much about France. and so in terms of fitting in and stuff, what kind of social groups were there and where did you fit in within that, do you think, or didn't you?
So, like, I think what I wanted to do was be kind of a manic pixie dream girl. That's what I wanted to do. Right. I wanted to be like the like smoking cigarettes behind school and just reading philosophy. But I still wasn't that. Like, I think I was. I think the closest I found to relating was being with big groups of nerds, and I think that I really liked hanging out with. People who were really into video games. And I think it's because we were on the same level in the sense that we didn't know where we were fitting. Mm-hmm. But like when you look at like my groups of friends now and the people I speak to, they're so varied. They're like just so many different people. I think for a long time I thought I was a metalhead and I was like, this is what I am. I love metal.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back, I think I was just looking for an easy way to be to fit in with people, because I think that as much as I love the music, I think it was more the sort of like I don't care sort of attitude,
right? So more of a lifestyle than the actual than a taste thing, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I always got on better with my brother's friends who were older than me, and mm-hmm. I remember when I was younger being so desperate to be in a conversation with adults. And now that I am 25, I realize they didn't know what they were talking about. Like, but I remember being younger and just wanting to be listened by adults and wanting them to think I was cool. And I was looking for that validation. Like I used to take it as a compliment when someone told me I was mature, which meant probably that I had some trauma that I wasn't dealing with. But yeah, I think my groups of friends were very... strange. There would be, I would get on with the popular girls at the beginning of the year because they thought I was quite funny, but then I would end up being bullied, and then I would join in the metal kids, and then I would join the art kids, and I was kind of in between everything. But which I think a lot of comedians have had the same experience.
Yeah, because I think so.
Yeah. I think now the people I relate to the most are comedians, which I think maybe was the people I was looking for the whole time.
That's interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that when you were saying about sort of trying to be seen, not taken seriously, but you said something about sort of like approval from older people and stuff. And people take, I think that is definitely a common thing with comedians. And just that idea of, it's funny because I feel like I've kind of found my people with comedy, but like you, like they're the most varied people I've ever met. So I had a similar thing. So when I was growing up, I was really into like punk and metal and stuff, which was a quite specific demographic of people. But now, like, I feel like I fit in more than anywhere else, but I people from so varied backgrounds and stuff. And you know, in terms of like class and upbringing and taste, like lifestyle, age, gender, sexuality, mm-hmm. everything. Maybe that's just part of getting older, but I definitely have much more varied friendship circle and stuff now that I'm in comedy, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I always think that, like, whenever I would be in a car share to go to a gig and you go, there is no way we would have ever met if it wasn't for comedy.
Like, it's fascinating, isn't it?
It's insane because, like, you look at... I often think about the comedians who are much older, like the circuit comedians, the people that have been grinding and like been doing 20 minutes at the weekend for 20 years. And I think, how strange is it that we're on the same bill Like we're on the same, like, and we're talking and we have a similar experience because we've been gigging. And I think there's something, I think without getting too emotional, I think there's something quite touching about that. The fact that it's kind of unifying, I think. And also like people who are, would be closer to me in terms of experience are also people sometimes I don't get on with. And I'm fascinated by what is the thing that makes me like people and makes them like me. And I think it's hard to describe. I think a lot of the time we try and find ways to boil it down to. So it could be, oh, you're working class and they're working class, or you're wearing too metal and they're wearing too metal. But I think it's it might be like a certain way of being sensitive. I think it's a certain way of that. That's why sometimes you see people get on so well and you don't get on with them. But I think there's something quite interesting about relating to other people. And I mean, on another level, there's also like the idea that I think I still need the approval from like older people. I think I still crave the approval from comedians that I admire, and I think maybe I've just transferred that, if that makes sense.
I think it is very easy to sort of psychoanalyze everything, but I've got a real tendency to do that. But I do think a lot of comedians, that in some way it's always been what they were going to do. Do you know what I mean? Even if it's just like being really interested in like performance, or like even just like celebrity or whatever, or always feeling like you didn't fit in and wanting people to listen to your opinion. You know, there's always something that has always been. It's very, very, very rare, it seems, that someone was just like, oh yeah, I'll give comedy a go. You know, it's like...
and these people are annoying because they're good at it. And so I don't like the myth of like, oh, to be a comedian, you need to be depressed. But when someone is like so normal and they do so well, it's like, you're just gifted then.
Why do you need this?
I know. It's like, I mean, how did you get into comedy? Were you like a performer? Did you want to perform, or did you want to...
I would say I'd always liked comedy, and I'd always tried to be funny and was kind of like a bit of the funny. I wasn't ever the funny one. I just had funny friends. I think we were all funny. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I had no, like, I've never really had like big ambition. I've never been like, I want to be this. I've kind of just been going through the motions, I think, in most of my life. And the other thing is, like, it's kind of a good trait and a bad trait, but one of my personality traits is that I don't do things unless I feel like I can be really good at them. So I like, and it's, there's not many things that you can just naturally be good at. You have to work at everything. But I just had this, I used to play basketball a lot when I was younger. And when I realized, like, I'm not tall enough. I've not got like the right coaching and stuff. I don't go to a decent school that has like the infrastructure. So I just gave up. I was like, well, I'll never be the best. So what's the point?
we had the exact same.
Had I carried on since then, I might be amazing now.
Do you know what? I had the exact same experience. It's funny you said that, because I feel like I tried so many different things. And it, like, I used to play guitar, and I started around the same time as my brother, who's again 7 years older than me. And then I played for 5 years and stopped because he was getting better than me, which is insane. Because as you said, if I had carried on, I would have probably been good now. But I generally feel the same way that I started painting this lockdown because I'm bad at it. And it's like, I think it's humbling. And comedy, I think, is humbling because it's hard to be... Very few people have had the opportunity to go on stage and tell a joke they believe in and no one likes it. And like, and you have to just move on. Because I think it's like, there's something quite... it's very making yourself vulnerable, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest joke that I'll never write a joke better than this. I started comedy to improve my self-esteem. That is the funniest thing I'll ever come up with, I think.
I know. It's insane, because especially because you're such a proactive writer that I do you find yourself like still being challenged in joke writing? Do you find
Oh yeah. Yeah, because the thing is, you spend a long time trying to get good at something, and then you get to a point where it's like, oh, I'm just doing the same thing because I've learned to get good at that. So now I'm like having to try and surprise myself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, the closest I could think of is, imagine like Picasso got to a point where it's like, I hate painting in blue. Like, everyone just knows me as the blue guy. I don't want to just be the blue guy. I'm going to draw weird faces from side on now.
No, absolutely.
I feel a bit, I'm not comparing, but just to be clear, I'm not comparing myself to Picasso.
Oh, I am. Squares.
But yeah, you get to a point where it's like, so you practice something to get good at it. And then you get to a point, it's like, well, now I'm good at it, but I need to be good at not being predictable and not doing the same thing. So I start, sometimes I'll write a joke that I know, or no, sorry, I suspect will get a good response. But I don't believe in it. Cause I'm like, I want to do something else. And then, I feel like kind of almost dirty doing it because I know that I could do not better, but what I want to do, you know?
Yeah.
So, because especially with comedy, there is you can just go to work today and just do anything you want. What other job can you do that? You can't just be like, I'm going to play football with my hands now. you can't do it. Like,
no, absolutely. And there's like,
so why wouldn't you, you know?
I think there's also a sense of like, comedy is so, I think I've definitely seen it this lockdown on Twitter, for example, where it's so like sick. It's almost like in cycles. It just, there's like, trends that come and go in comedy and what jokes work and what jokes don't. Like, I think that we're, for a long time we were away from men versus women stuff, but I think that slowly we're coming back at it, and it's almost like fashion. It's like, I think that I love one-liners, and I think they're coming back as well, but I know that for the first few years of me doing comedy, I would rarely see a one-liner comedian. It would very much be like observational stuff. It's the same way that like alternative comedy, I think, is something that I see so little of it for a while, and then it just booms. And I love alternative comedy. But I think it's like, with joke writing, I like to see it as like, it's almost music theory, but I have to figure it out myself. Like, there's no books.
Yeah, that's really true.
I think that's what I find fascinating. Because also I get bored when I think of comedy as just A plus B equals C. I like to, like, that's why I really like your stuff, because you really just play with the format so much.
I think that I was hoping we could dedicate like a whole 5 minutes to me. Is that right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But like, oh, no, I appreciate that. Thanks.
No, definitely. I think that there's like a huge amount of pressure in comedy to be successful and not try new things where you're bad at them at first. And I think that I really admire when I see, like, I tweeted that the other day, I really miss seeing a comedian that I really like try new things.
Yeah, totally.
I really, really miss that. But anyway, we derailed from where I was from.
No, that's all right. It's fine. I mean, it's because it all impacts on where you are and where you're going. Yeah. So it's all relevant to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you kind of said already that it's kind of like, no, there was no like famous hip hop or anything that came out. So the way I try and approach this question is, it's about like, if you were to meet someone from a different town or a different suburb and you wanted to kind of maybe show off a bit or impress them or give them a reason to come and hang out with you, what would that be about District 93?
I would say that, that's a good question. I would ask them, first of all, if they've seen La Haine, which is a very good French film.
I don't want to embarrass you, but it's pronounced alien.
I've just been French-splained. it's a very good film. And I would say something along the lines of, oh, you know, where I grew up, it was kind of like La Haine, which A, makes me look like I watch black and white films. And B, makes me look like my story is deeper than growing up near the Eiffel Tower, which is a good brag, I think. Like, most days I try and tell people that I watch black and white films.
Well, I'm just really glad to know how to finally pronounce that, because I'm one of those people that, you know, I'm really pretentious, and I might have name dropped that in a conversation about film and been pronouncing it. You know, La Haine, you've seen La Haine, it's dead good.
I feel like, yeah, I'm with you. I feel like there's nothing more embarrassing to me than being in a conversation and everyone's talking about like a book they've read. And I haven't. That's one thing I'm bad at as well. I'm not very good at reading, and I completely blame myself and my phone. But I wish could read just so I could have the satisfaction of telling people I read.
Yeah, well, I'm not a big reader, and I've got like an anecdote from when I was at school about this, because I got a C in English literature, right? Mm-hmm. And which is incredible, because I mean, it's not an amazing grade, but it's when I tell you what I'm about to tell you, you will think, well, that is a good grade. The book we were studying was called The Withered Arm, right? Mm-hmm. And the whole time, like, I hadn't read it, and I thought the teacher was saying the River Dam. So she was quite posh, and I was like, oh, the river Dam. Which is like, posh people don't even pronounce dam like that. They still say dam.
I know.
But I had it in my head as the River Dam, and I got a C.
That reminds me of I had a philosophy exam at school, and the question was, how do we know that science is real? And I was just getting into stand-up and George Carlin, and I basically just quoted his religion bit onto the paper. I had the worst grade of the class, but because I was such a wanker, I had so much confidence in it, I was like, religion isn't true. I think I really went through a horrible atheist phase. I think it comes from just wanting to be different. Now I'm more like, everybody can do whatever they want.
Yeah, like, totally, totally. Yeah, I think it's also a very much part of being a metalhead, isn't it? It's being an atheist. yeah, that's funny.
But yeah, I think that I would tell them about that. And I would also, I think that a lot of people, when you tell them that you're from France, if you tell a Londoner that you're from Paris, because a lot of them tend to be hipsters and want to look sophisticated, they'll be like, I've actually been on the outskirts of Paris. So I feel like I could grab some like attention from that.
Right, got you.
So yeah, I'm from the non-gentrified part yet, which...
Give it time.
4 more years.
Do you, I know you said it was kind of boring and stuff, but do you feel nostalgic for where you, do you go back often? Do you miss it?
So that's the thing, is that my my family actually moved. My mom got moved out of the flat we grew up in, and she now lives in the countryside of Paris. She lives in a tiny little village. It's strange because the first time I went back home, and I wasn't going back to the flat I grew up in, I felt like this sadness, but it was also like, it was very freeing as well. Because I think that there's very little chances that we have in life to let go of the past. And I think that's something that's like as concrete as literally moving house. I think it really hit me in a way that I didn't expect. I think what I miss about that place is I think that had I been more mature, if I'd be the person I am now, I think I would have probably enjoyed more things about it than I did back then. I think I was very judgmental of it. And I was very judgmental towards the people. And I think that it's something that now I don't know if I've romanticized it, but I genuinely think that there's a certain beauty in people just not leaving their town and just being happy that way. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've always felt like people who don't do comedy and just have a day job and their little dog and their little house, I think there's something quite nice about that. If that makes sense.
Like, no, I know what you mean. I think, yeah, do you think it's, I think there's definitely a big bit of ego with comedy and stuff, because the way I liken it is, so when I went to university in Southampton, and I didn't particularly like it. I didn't hate it, but it's not a very cool place. There's not much of an art scene. There's not much of any scene. It's just one of those places, right? And then I moved from there to Brighton, which obviously has a lot more of a buzz and stuff.
Yeah.
But when I went back for the first time to Southampton, I felt really sad and sort of nostalgic. But I realised it came from a really sort of self-centred place, because basically what it was like, oh, no one knows who I am.
Yeah,
like there's all these new people here that are having their story at university, they're having their experience, and they're living in my old house and they don't even know who I am.
Do you know what, I had a conversation with someone about that, a friend of mine, but a few years back, about space and houses and how we're in a house where loads of stuff happens. Like people fell in love, had heartbreak and all of that sort of thing, and we just don't know. I genuinely had the same thing when, because obviously I moved to Birmingham from that little place, and a lot of people don't get why it was an upgrade, but Birmingham is a bit bigger city than the one I'm from.
You hear Paris and you think, you know, culture, food and stuff, and then you hear Birmingham, you think canals, you know. So
yeah, and maybe
Black Sabbath if you're really generous, you know.
I know, Birmingham is just more of a cultured city than the one I'm from outside Paris. Yeah. That's what I loved about Birmingham, is that, to be honest, I was like, this is quite a big city. Is this New York? And I was like, I still feel like, because my boyfriend lives in London, so I'm down in London a lot. Whereas I'm in London, when I feel in London, I sort of feel like, I still feel like I'm from the outskirts of London. It's very strange. I think that when I went back to Paris, I think it was a couple years ago now, I stayed in the center of Paris as opposed to staying at home.
Right.
And I had a completely different experience than I did growing up. It was so different. And I generally think it's very much is like two completely different cities, but just there's just one train. It's 15 minutes away, but it was so different. But Birmingham is like, that's why I think I really like Birmingham. I think it's because it's much more vibrant and interesting than where I'm from. And then, and I think that's why I've always liked doing comedy in small town as well. And like going around, is because to me it's all very exciting for someone who had like barely traveled. But I mean, Brighton felt like a beach town. I loved Brighton. This is incredible. It felt like a level on Mario Kart. It was beautiful.
I like that. Yeah, it's not very multicultural, Brighton, I'll say that. But it's pretty cool. It can be a bit up its own arse. It's a bit like people say it's like Shoreditch by the sea, you know, it's kind of like, but I would argue that at least in Shoreditch, people actually do stuff. So Brighton is kind of like, the way one of my university lecturers, because I said I was moving to Brighton and stuff, he said, Brighton is full of really interesting, talented, creative people. Yeah. Stirring their cappuccinos. And that is what it is, kind of like, they're not a lot really gets done, but we're very proud to be there.
That's really funny.
Yeah, we've got here, that's enough. Like, we're in the cool place. We don't have to do anything now. Yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah. Do you think that where you are geographically changes your approach to creativity? Like, do you feel like being in a place that isn't as nice makes you like sort of hustle a bit more?
I think it's got to have an impact, and I think so. Maybe it's ego again as well, but like in Southampton, I went there to study art and stuff, specifically illustration. But I was at my most creative, and so me and friends would do we'd put on our own public exhibitions in an alleyway and stuff like that, and we'd go into town and just draw people in the street and stuff, and we were really thought we were shaking, you know, things up.
Yeah.
And then I moved because there was nothing going on, so we had to do something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then in Brighton it's kind of oh, I'll do it next week.
No, absolutely.
Because you're competing with other people, so you don't get to be a big deal.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I think I feel the same when I'm in London, because I think when I won the Breaking Talent thing in Birmingham, for me that was huge, and I felt like Birmingham was my home, and I was like, yeah. And then I came to London and everyone was like, sorry, are you on the bill? And it was and I had this moment of yeah, I'm on the bill. And then everyone just going, yeah, it didn't happen in London, so we don't care.
Oh, that is very true. I used to, when I was quite new, it doesn't happen so much anymore, but I loved going up to London to gig, because I was an outsider. So people didn't know who it was. They'd just be like, oh, it's just another overweight, bearded white guy. You know what I mean? It's I've no interest in what this guy has to say. So I love surprising them. Oh, right, he's doing something a bit different, you know. Now, I'm not saying I'm really original with it. I'm just meaning it's not necessarily I mean, but like to look at me, I think people think something and then I like surprising them. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. So. I think that that's one thing about you and your act in general is I think you're very original as a person because you are Craig that we could see you get on stage and just be like, oh, he's going to do a routine about, I don't know, Aldi self-checkout. But then you actually do something that's original. I think just the fact that you do very like good one-liners, which I don't see that many one-liner comics anymore. And it's a shame because I love one-liners.
I think sometimes there's lots of covert one-liner acts, right?
Yeah.
So like, I think it's like you were saying about fashion earlier, I think it's not been like cool. I don't think it's ever been like cool, but it's certainly not been cool for a long time. Like if it ever has been. And it's associated often with, cause a lot of old school kind of sexist comedy, that was a bit like one-linery, yeah. Right? But so was every type of comedy. It's just that that's the stuff that's sort of been remembered. But I think so now, I think people try and trick the audience into not realizing they're listening to one-liners. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
I think, I don't know if it's conscious, but like, so someone like Glenn Moore, he is a one-liner act. People, I have arguments about this all the time, but he is a one-liner act. But he's just, his stories are so dense with jokes that you don't notice that he's telling jokes. They seem like stories. And George Lewis, like definitely a one-liner act.
I think, yeah, absolutely. I think that's definitely, it's interesting you say that because that's definitely what I do when I write a one-liner. I'm like, okay, I need to like pad it up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I need to make it cushy and add some stories to it. Just because I think that it takes like, I think that the confidence of going on and just saying the one-liner, I think it's very rare to see it go well. Like Mark Simmons is incredible at one-liners, for example. Yeah, and whenever I see him, I'm like, I admire just him going through one-liners for 20 minutes and it works and he gets a laugh. Because I think you need to have such good and sharp jokes that it's almost like a factory, isn't it? You can just like, you have to, you made the product, you're giving it out and you don't have time to sell it. The same, if that makes sense.
I get you, yeah. I think a lot with him as well is his persona is good because he doesn't come across like he thinks he's so clever and so funny.
Yeah.
He delivers it as a kind of, not like a nudge in a wink, but kind of like, this is silly, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And no, so absolutely. People can get on board with that. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I think the another one I love, and I'll stop just talking about the comedians I love, is
that's all right.
Josh Pugh he writes such perfect jokes and they always surprise me, and
right.
He's kind of one-liners but he hides them as well a little bit, or maybe because he acts them out. I think he's very, very good at that. He's probably my favorite comic to see try new stuff.
I really, really, really want to see him. I follow him on Twitter and I think he's very funny, and people like I've seen, he's one of those people that I'm really intimidated by because like, again, like with, you know what I'm saying? Like I only want to do things that I can be really good at. So I kind of cultivated an act that was my act so that I didn't have to like compare myself to people. But, and then I remember when I first saw Simon Lomas, I was like, holy shit, someone's doing kind of what I do. And I was really depressed about it. I was like, I had like a proper existential crisis when I saw him. I was like, oh no, someone else is doing like a weirdo one-liner act, which isn't even that uncommon really. But
no, but I think you're quite different. That's the thing. I think there's a lot, you two have completely different energies, I think.
Oh yeah.
I
mean, yeah.
I think that like Simon Lomas, I think I remember I used to live with a guy who worked at Glee Birmingham, and he would have stories of Simon just going on and not saying anything for the first minute or so. I think that there's definitely room for the both of you. There's the writing is so different as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, well, I think it was actually the best thing that could happen to me because it forced me to really figure out what I was doing and have an original act.
Yeah.
Cozy, it was like, because everyone, like most people, is like a kind of default kind of comedy. I'm not flagging it off, but like there's a type of comedy that's the most kind of familiar, and that's kind of like conversational, observational, you know. And so I was like, okay, I'm on the outside without being that far on the outside, and then so that forced me to be like, no, that's not enough, I need to really hone this down, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I feel the same way with me being French Algerian, that sort of thing, because I've never wanted to be the French Algerian act, that makes sense. I never wanted to be the, oh, this is the person that just talks about that. I've always wanted it to have layers to it, and I love writing jokes, and I think that I I definitely am in competition with like my previous jokes. So if I came up with a good joke like last year, I'm always like trying to do better. But I also think that it's because I think it comes down to the validation thing. Like I really want people in my favorite writers and my favorite comedians to say that what I'm doing is good. And I think it's probably not the right way of doing things, because really you should be focusing on the audience. But
I'm exactly the same. If I see one comedian laugh at the back of the room, that means more to me than getting a round of applause from the audience.
Yes. Like, yeah. And it almost feels cheap when like there's a joke out that I know isn't great, but it gets a good response. I always sometimes I'll be like, oh, I should get rid of that. But I think it comes down to doing what you want to do at the end of the day. And I think that it shows when a comedian is being truly themselves, I think, on stage, when they're not trying to be to fit within what they think comedy is. And that's what they tell you, I think, when you start doing comedy in general, is they say, just do what you think is funny. And a lot of the time it will be stuff that is weirder. And I love seeing a comedian like do something that is so them that doesn't work, and then work on it until it works, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I mean, do you have any jokes that only you like believe in, but like you really like this?
Yeah, there's a few, like, because I love writing stuff that doesn't sound like a joke. It's really hard to sell that to an audience, because it's like, how do they know that that's what you're doing? Because do you know my favorite joke that doesn't work, and I bring it back every now and again, but it never works. And another thing I really, really into is like economy of joke telling. So if I can say it in as few words as possible, and that combines a few things. And I think it's five words. It's you never see recluses anymore. And it just never works. Well, it just does sometimes.
That's really good.
There's no setup or punchline. It's just a statement, you know.
Yeah, I think it's like who else had a really good joke? There's Danny Clives used to say, "Any shy people in here tonight?"
Oh yeah.
And
then and
it's like, I think I like jokes that make you go, oh, more than ha ha ha. I think it's probably very wanky of me, but I really like jokes that are like, that aren't actually laugh out loud funny, but will make me respect someone.
Yeah. No, I have that with this one. Do you know Patrick Spicer?
Yes. Yeah.
He used to do that. He doesn't do it anymore. It's a bit what you're saying about like, kind of like it being a cheap thing. So for him, I think he said like, oh, it just feels like a cheap joke, but it was one of my favourite jokes, and honestly, I've never ever wanted to take someone's joke before or ask them if I can have it, but I really want this joke. he'd come out and he'd say, "Good evening, London. Can I call you London?" I just thought that was brilliant.
That's like, really funny. Yeah. That's really funny. Have you heard of this guy that would, oh God, I forgot his name, but he would come on and say, "It's great to be here in SE5 and just like read out the postcode.
No, I don't know that one. I like that though.
Really thought
that. And it's because it plays with the conventions of what people expect and what's the normal, like, oh, hey, good evening, whatever town it is and stuff. I think that's great. And playing with the specificity of it and turning things on its head. I love that kind of stuff.
Do you know who I really like as well though, who isn't necessarily like a joke writer? And I know she gets a bad rap, but in the comedy world, but I think Amy Schumer's great. Like,
oh yeah, she's very funny. Yeah,
like she had a joke in her latest special where she goes, she hates how people go on stage and go, "Chicago, you got me fucked up last night," and then she goes, "Okay, we weren't here last night." Like, I think she's brilliant. Like, and I think it's crazy that women like that. I kept doing comedy whenever I would watch a video of female stand-up, the YouTube comments would be, "Women aren't funny." That's insane to me that we carry on when we have so much stuff telling us not to do it.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, I don't envy you that. If you could start all over again and there was, like, a form to fill in and you were asked, like, right, okay, so you get to grow up anywhere you want, tick the box, and what time, you know, like, now, the future, the past, any time in history, what would your selection be for that?
Ooh, that's interesting. I think I'd I think what I would do, can I have two choices?
Yeah, do what you want.
So the first thing I would do is exactly where I'm from, but 10 years before. So
right.
I can come up with the iPhone. and the second answer is I'm always fascinated with what will happen in 1,000 years. Like I'm fascinated with time and like how limited time we have here and how I'm gutted that I won't get to see what happens in 1,000 years. So we'll be in precisely 1,000 years from now. And I will write, I don't know. I think I would just like to live, 1,000 years from now in, what is up and coming? What's the city that's up and coming?
Oh gosh, I don't know.
I think I'd live, probably I'd love to have grown up in America. Just because I really want to have like a Valley Girl type accent.
Because I think really? It's
funny. probably in America 1,000 years from now when it's all come down in crumbles. But not, 10 years before exactly the place I was born and come up with something amazing. I probably should have said something like kill Hitler, but that's like, I don't think it would be easy. So it's probably...
No, he was a pretty hard baby, but... Also, I mean, I don't, not to get too political and stuff, but these people, they are the manifestation of ideas. They aren't the ideas themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is supposed to be a comedy podcast, but yeah.
No, absolutely. I think that if it wasn't for him, it would have been someone else.
Oh, and totally, yeah.
So I think that it's like with Donald Trump, when people say, oh, wait, Donald Trump is at fault. He isn't.
I think he's all right.
I think he's a great guy. But I think that he's obviously a horrible person, but I think that the anger and the people were easily led to that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. People want to see straightforward answers to complicated things, yeah. And that's why I'm starting the Reclaim Party for the UK. I'm joining Lawrence Fox. We're starting a podcast, yeah. well, it's been really great talking to you. I feel like I know you better now. It's like I said, you know, I don't get to talk to comics as much as I'd like to, especially during lockdown, but even before. So this has been really fun catching up. Is there anything that you want to tell people about? Have you got anything going on?
Well, I've not really, actually. I'm quite good on Twitter, so that'd be good for people to follow me on that, because it's literally the only thing I've got going on at the moment. What else? If somebody could explain to me how I can return a couple of dresses I've bought online that don't fit, because I don't understand how to do it, that would be great.
Yeah, I'm sure I can. I'm sure I can facilitate that. Yeah, I'm sure someone out there. Didn't you just record something that's
quite big? So that was for BBC I think it was Festival of Funny. And my agent, who's wonderful, managed to get me onto the lineup. With the idea was that if they have time, they'll put it on TV. But if not, I get a nice shiny footage of my set, and I get to like
an
experience.
Win-win.
Yeah,
lovely.
It was great because especially with at the minute, and it's very hard to get your set recorded, obviously. But I didn't have a really nice video because you know, like you just put your phone at the back of the room and just wait. But it was really lovely. And like, I think it's a really nice introduction to TV stuff because it really is no pressure. And I met some of my favorite comedians. And then hopefully I can do some more writing on News Quiz soon. I'll wait for them to ask me again because that was really fun.
Did you do a writer's room?
No, I think I did a tweet last year, which went viral and then was stolen by about 50 different accounts, which was the support Buble thing. And
that's great.
And I think they probably saw that, and then my agent got in touch with them and they got me in for 2 episodes. And I've got an actual video of me listening to the show, listening to my first, the first joke I ever wrote on air. And you can see I'm like shaking. I'm like so excited.
That's cool.
Because you've done some stuff for the writing rooms, haven't you? Like the writer's room.
Yeah. So I did a news chat writer's room and a news quiz writer's room, which was really fun, really different, especially news Jack, because I was in writing sketch and I've never done sketch before, so I found that quite
hard. Really?
Yeah, but I managed to get one on, so that felt like an accomplishment, because I've gone from writing no sketch to getting something on, so that was great.
That's amazing. But, yeah. How long before you got your first sketch on? Was that the first one you wrote, or did you have to just write a couple?
No, so I was writing one-liners for, you know, just the open submissions, but yeah. I think it's more to do with, because I was in the BBC New Comedian competition, and they usually get a lot of people that are in that to come into the writer's room. So it's more, yeah. It was that, but also submitting stuff, yeah. But so I was submitting one-liners, and I got a few on, took a while. Like I was doing it years ago, and I didn't get anything on, but,
mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, so it was a bit of a surprise because we're like, oh, can you come into the writer's room? I was like, yeah. And then I found out I was doing sketch. I was like, oh shit, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not going to say no, you know what I mean? So
yeah, no, of course.
Sometimes jumping at the deep end is the best thing you can do, though, I think.
Absolutely. I think that if your first gig is a good gig and the second is a bad one, I think that is better than having just had good gigs your whole life.
Oh, totally.
Like, definitely. But yeah, it was so nice talking to you. Really interesting. I think we've never like hung out properly as well, even though I've heard your stuff on Twitter and I think you're great. It's always been very like from a distance. So I'm really glad we got to have a chat.
Yeah, because we met in, the Midlands. It was Leicester, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah.
It was one of Spiky Mike's gigs, like a gong show, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jeez, that was so long ago.
Yeah, I know. It's strange, isn't it?
It's three or four years ago. Mm. God, I remember that. There was, that was the Kyle or something like that. I think
it's like a curry house, yeah. Yeah.
I remember that. I bumped into you in Leicester. I think you were with... Were Jen, you with Jen?
Yeah.
The cash machine. Remember that.
We were just about to get the bus, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, brilliant.
Fun times. I miss bumping into people at a cash machine in Leicester. bring it back.
Miss bumping into people.
There we go. Another episode down. That's Celia AB on Stomping Grounds. I hope you've been enjoying the show so far. I've got a few more episodes in this series before I have a little break. If you have been enjoying it, please give me a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast that you can do reviews. I'm not really sure. And tell your friends about it. Follow me on Twitter at It's William Stone. Let me know what you think. Cheers for coming. I love you. Bye.